you can sum up leadership in two phrases. Number one, it's not all about you. And number two, it's all about you.
Hello and welcome to V for Visionaries podcast with me, Richard Ward. I am an award-winning serial entrepreneur with over 35 years experience in the beauty and media world. And I've built and sold many businesses. But today I'm most interested in finding out who are the movers and shakers in business, what makes them so successful, and why certain cream rises to the top.
And me, Rosamund Stenhouse. I am an award-winning fourth generation of entrepreneurs. I have spent several decades working with all aspects of land, delivering new towns and large-scale landmass for development. I now work with national and international entrepreneurs, scaling, improving sales, and expanding their business. This is the podcast where bold ideas meet business brilliance.
Yes, and each week we'll be sitting down with trailblazing entrepreneurs and industry leaders to uncover the strategies, the stories, and the secrets behind some of the world's most exciting business ventures. So today on V for Visionaries, Jim Tapper. He is an ex-CEO and former managing partner of Deloitte. With 30 years' experience advising FTSE 100 and Fortune 500 leaders. If that hasn't been enough of a stellar career, Jim left the corporate world to become a psychotherapist to CEOs and business leaders. He is currently CEO of Tapper Associates. So welcome to V for Visionaries, Jim Tapper. Where do we start with all this? Narcissism, it's psychotherapy. And I know this is going to be absolutely hugely welcomed by all of our listeners, just to listen to your story. But can I take you straight back? You were born in America, right?
That's correct. And I spent about half my professional career in the United States and half in Europe.
Okay, so talk us through what sort of family did you come from? To, I mean, you rose to be a CEO. I mean, you're advising FTSE 100 companies. How do you get to that?
Well, in my family, when I was growing up, education and achievement were very important, and so those two things combined really were the impetus for trying to be successful, trying to move up the corporate ladder. And that's exactly what I did in my career. And now I'm trying to bring some of the lessons that I've learned to people who have walked that same walk.
Were you born into money, or were you born into a middle-class family? What were you, or poverty? What were you, what was your environment?
I was born into a middle-class family. I had the fortunate circumstance of being able to attend law school and then to get my psychology degree. So, it was, as I said, education was really paramount in my upbringing.
So Jim, just taking you back to the psychology degree came much later, didn't it, in life? You trained as a lawyer, but you weren't a lawyer. You didn't become a lawyer. So how did you get into consulting?
I practiced law very briefly. Didn't really enjoy it. I much more enjoyed the consulting side of things, which is about solving problems. I felt that lawyers sometimes were putting up barriers, and I didn't enjoy that very much. So I moved into consulting pretty early in my career.
Jim, can I just ask you, when a company hires a consultant, do you have to have a knowledge of a consultant across a broad spectrum of industries? Because I think to myself, well, you know, as a consultant, how can you advise the oil and gas industry? Do you have to have some kind of training in that? I mean, or do you have to, is it a very niche thing, consultancy, or can it be very broad?
When you're trying to advise a company in the energy field on strategy, then yes, you do have to have a knowledge of that particular sector. And I did, because I worked in the United States Congress writing bills and legislation on energy. And then for the International Energy Agency in Paris, where I worked for a number of years before moving to the United Kingdom. But when I moved to people consulting full-time, that is a transferable skill across sectors. And so it becomes more about your knowledge of that particular, whether it's HR or it's about counseling people through the changes, that is actually something that's much more transferable across sectors.
So what was the general remit that would be asked of you from a people consulting perspective when you were going into these companies? What was the objective they were trying to achieve?
Various things. So a trigger for that would be a company that is changing their strategies, let's say moving into new markets or in introducing new products. And therefore, the analysis that we would help them do is their workforce fit for purpose for that new strategic direction? And that means not only functional skills, but also leadership skills. And so, you know, is an executive able to lead an organization through change and have the right leadership skills to do so?
What personality traits would you immediately look for in each person when you're looking for someone that can actually transition through a leadership role or into a leadership role in that environment?
Well, things have changed over the years. Very early on, there was this whole idea back in the 80s, for example, of a hero CEO, somebody that people looked up to and said, I want to be just like that CEO, and I'm going to model myself over that individual. Things have changed quite a lot today, and it's more about personality traits for the individual themselves, about being empathetic, understanding, being a manager as a coach, so really coaching the individuals in their teams, and being able to set out a vision, not because they are the wonderful, you know, hero, but because it is the way that the company wants to move and that everybody in the company, this is where empathy comes in, has a part to play in that. And so things have changed over the years. And those are the kind of personality traits today that are most important in leaders.
I think that is sometimes often misunderstood, where it's almost like it's not a subservient mentality, but is a service to the company. In a way, maybe, are you describing it as a CEO being someone that is literally, as the Queen would service, you know, would submit herself to Great Britain, for example? Are you describing a CEO in today's culture that would literally, everything he does is for the greater good of the company as a whole?
Well, Roz, you hit on a very, very good point. And the way I describe leadership today to people in the workshops that I run and put together is, you can sum up leadership in two phrases. Number one, it's not all about you. And number two, it's all about you. So in number one, it's the service mentality that you just mentioned. The Queen, for example, is a very good example of that. In other words, you want others to be successful, so you enable them and you give them the tools necessary to be able to do their jobs. On the other hand, it's all about you, meaning you are a role model for everyone else. And so when you sneeze, everyone else catches a cold as a CEO or a senior leader. And so you have a responsibility to be a role model and walk the talk. So it's those two phrases, if you will, that really sum up what leadership is about.
Yeah, Jim, can you teach that? I mean, because a lot of CEOs, I mean, to get to that position, or as you say, business leaders, you know, these people, you know, they have their own way of doing things. I mean, can a leopard change its spots?
Yes. If you have a one-size-fits-all approach to leadership, then you're bound to either be successful or fail miserably, because every business context is different. Every organization, and you see senior leaders moving from one organization to another, every organization is different with its own context, with its own culture. And so in order to be successful, serially successful, you have to have the ability to be flexible and be empathetic, as I was saying before. Otherwise, if you have a one-size-fits-all approach, chances are you'll be successful sometime, but not all the time.
Do you think it's an instinctive trait that some leaders just have, the understanding that they must live and abide by the greater good of the company in order to lead that company and lead by example? I think that, you know, the old adage of there was more in the old days, I think there was more of a dictatorship
you know, where people stayed in companies when they were 14 years old, they would join the company, or maybe, you know, they'd stay with that company 20, 30, 40 years. That's gone. So there needs to be something radically different to keep people at companies, considering they jump around so much. Is this the most effective leadership that you've observed?
So that first part of leadership, which is about being a servant leader, is what's very important. So giving people the resources and the support to do their jobs actually makes people feel valued and engaged. If in the old days, this sort of dictatorial approach, the hero worship that I was talking about before, really, it just doesn't work nowadays. I mean, everybody wanted to be like Jack Welch from General Electric in the 80s and 90s. And that was fine for that time. But, you know, we are so much interdependent today because of the advance of social media and the internet that those kinds of things don't last very long. So I don't think it's necessarily an ingrained personal trait to want to be a servant leader. Some need coaching and some therapy to help them get there and to be able to act in a way that's going to prolong the success of the company and their position in a role.
Do you think, Jim, what was flashing through my mind there is, I'm just throwing this out there, are we in danger of becoming too much of a nanny state in that sense? In business, are we getting too empathetic with people? Are we just worrying, is there a danger of it becoming too far the other way?
Of course. A good leader also has to be able to take the tough decisions and implement a strategy in a way that's going to be right for the resources that the company has or needs to get to be able to be successful. So it is a balance. And that's why so many chief executives or very senior executives wrestle with the ability to deliver. There's incredible pressure on senior executives today by boards, by investors, by their own personal financial goals to be successful. And so they wrestle with that balance between taking the tough decisions, doing the right thing, going down that particular road, and being able to connect with people, help them be the best that they can be in their organization to do the right thing. I mean, look, you can't anymore be the only one who is setting the direction and trying to get the job done. That's too much pressure on any executive. There's an old adage, I don't know who started it, but it takes a village, and it really does, in big organizations or small, to go down the strategic path and be successful.
Just listening to you, it suddenly occurred to me, to reach the highest height of a CEO of a global company, you'd have to have a very, very strong sense of self and a very clear understanding of who you are. Is that where you reference the therapy, the psychotherapy, where maybe on some of them will not have such a solid, because in order to be a servant leader, which actually I was thinking is probably the one that has the least ego in it, because you kind of want to get the ego put aside. That's caring what people think and all that, because then you're very impinged to actually do a good job if you're constantly concerned about what other people think as a CEO. The therapy that you just mentioned earlier, how do you rebuild a man? Because he's going to be coming in the door with all kinds of childhood issues. I mean, all kinds of things. Every person is human. How do you start with building that self, a clear self, so that he can or she can go out and conquer the world in her world confidently and without this concern for what other people think and actually give all to the company?
So there's a psychological phrase or a tool to a certain extent called a schema, which is a mental model. And we all have a mental model of who we are, ourselves, and how we react to the environment around us or whatever life puts in our direction. Many who are called to be a senior executive or a CEO have a healthy dose of self-belief, But very often, right behind that healthy dose of self-belief is a serious questioning, which some people call an imposter syndrome, right? Do you feel like you belong in that role? And because of those pressures I mentioned earlier, that can be debilitating to a number of people. And so hiding behind that self-belief is often that questioning that goes on. And that adds to the pressure that a CEO, a male or a female CEO, doesn't really matter, has to try to reach the expectations, not only of themselves, but of their board or their financial support, or even their own financial or career goals. So, you know, it's not all solid self-belief. In my experience, almost every CEO has that niggling doubt that they may not be up to the job.
Do you find it more prevalent in, a private company? The CEO is very likely to still be around. The chairman's still going to be there. Maybe the founder's still going to be there. And there's a support structure around him. I often think that the CEOs most at risk are the ones when they start going into the public companies. And they are effectively a lot further from the original creator. They haven't got that sort of dripping of the support and the information exchange, that vital problem solving, bouncing off. Have you experienced that or seen that?
I would question the underlying assumption in your comment, Roz, because I find in smaller companies, particularly where the founder is still involved, and let's say they might bring in a CEO to professionalize the organization, to matriculate to a higher growth level, very often that's also a very difficult position for a CEO to be in. And so there are all kinds of different kinds of pressures than you have in the very large organization that you describe. I have seen a number of my clients who I provide therapy or executive coaching to who are in that position. And when the founder is still there, founders find it very hard to take a step back from the organization. And therefore, they really can be very difficult to deal with for a CEO who's come in to professionalize an organization.
Do you find, Jim, when you've got somebody sitting in front of you and the very same people that we've been talking about today, do you ever sit there thinking, I don't know how you've got to where you are today because you're full of narcissism, you're full of imposter syndrome, you are not particularly a very nice person, and I've got so much work to do with you, and how have you got to where you have today? I mean, are you constantly surprised by these people?
It's horses for courses. You get all different kinds of people. I've had some real tough cases of people that maybe didn't even want to come to coaching or therapy, but were asked by their chairman, for example, to seek some help because they were ruffling too many feathers and they were concerned about the efficacy of that particular executive. I consider that a challenge. It's about establishing trust first. So I show my vulnerability and in the way I've moved in my career through senior executive positions and CEO positions, and what I've learned, and then help people to see a bit of themselves through someone else's lens.
Let me ask you, just flicking to female CEOs, there is tell me I'm wrong, but there seems to be two sort of choices female CEOs make. They either are able to maintain their femininity in a male-dominated environment, and thrive and create effectively a defense around that. The feminine side actually creates a bubble of defense, or they become quite masculating. They demasculate men. Their life is really about validating how more masculine they are than the men around them. How does a woman CEO not fall into that trap? Because I think
good question.
I would say two observations about that. I think it used to be much more the latter, where women felt that they had to be as tough as the men and as masculine, if you will, as the men. I think it's less prevalent today than it was maybe in the 80s and 90s and in the early 2000s. I think women are starting to have a much more confident sense of self in their femininity and their ability, as I said before, to bring in networks of people to help them be successful and to use the things that are naturally part of the way that they would operate. I think that's number one. Number two, if they don't have that and they're struggling with how do I position myself in the male-female dynamic, that's where work on a very good self-schema or sense of self can help them make the right choice. I come from a family of very strong women, and I've seen, a lot of them are lawyers, and I've seen some of them go down the path of masculinity, if you will, and some of them use their natural feminine ability to be successful. And in my view, you know, really because of my experience, that the women who are able to maintain their femininity and use all of their femininity in the right way are more successful.
There is a very difficult balance that female CEOs, as we try and establish, you know, the position and the place, you know, when there is a lot of men around, they are quite pack-like. They do like, you know, being men's men. How does she stop? You know, what is, because a lot of them do end up very masculated and demasculating men. How do you retract from that position as a woman who's got stuck in that groove? How do you help them say, look, get back to your feminine self? I love being a woman. Do you love being a woman? I think that, you know, I've said this before. There was a man, I said this to Richard, there was a man on a train. He jumped up and offered this woman a seat. She was a very elegant looking woman. And she screeched and screamed and took offense and was vile and just was awful. It was so embarrassing. The man was of a slightly older generation. He went very red. And he looked so utterly embarrassed, and the whole coach would look, and everyone was frozen because this society today doesn't know what to do anymore. And no one jumped up in his defense. You'd think the men would. Anyway, I jumped up and I said, thank you very much. I'll take that seat. It's very kind of you. And sat down and thought, screw you. And this whole movement that men can't open doors for women or you can't offer a seat. I will take that seat. Thank you. What is wrong with saying thank you as a woman to a man? It's empowering.
Nothing. And I would add, you know, offering your seat to anybody who looks like they might need it or want it, whether they're a man or a woman, would be an appropriate way of acting. I mean, that's, I don't think that there's a position of wokeness or not wokeness in acting that particular way. I think that woman could have handled it better by, as you say, just saying thank you very much, but you know, I don't need it, or you know, whatever. That is a matter of common decency, I think, rather than anything else.
Very diplomatically put, Jim. Very diplomatically yes. put. Now we've got about 10 minutes left, Max, and Roz will lead the close. But just one question I want to ask you, and just for our listeners and viewers out there. They want to come. Somebody's watching or listening to this and they say to themselves, do you know what? I need a touch of Jim Tapper. So Richard or Roz, we call you and we say, we've got a myriad of problems here. You know, can you help me? Is there a benchmark to how many sessions I might need with you? That's one question. And the second question is, do I really, really need and want to be helped by Jim in order for Jim to make things change for me?
So at the beginning of any engagement with somebody who's seeking help or wants to talk about having help, I have a what I call a chemistry session. It's very often called a chemistry session, where you sit and you talk about what it is they are looking to achieve. And that will normally dictate. And we get a little bit into their background and all of that. And that will normally dictate how much I think they would be welcoming help and whether I can help them. If they decide that they want to move forward, then we have a longer session at the very beginning where we create a therapy or a coaching contract, which says, and it's not a contract, a written contract, but we look at together to decide what they want to achieve, what success would look like, and how to measure it. And then I can make a suggestion about how many sessions. Sometimes it's open-ended, and we just decide at the beginning to have it every week. And then, you know, it might, over a period of time, when you review and see how progress has come, to move to every 2 weeks or once a month. And so sometimes it is open-ended. Sometimes it is, particularly in executive coaching, which is a bit different than therapy, you might say, well, we'll start with a package of 6 sessions or 10 sessions, and then we'll reevaluate and see where we've gone, where we've come to. Therapy normally is more open-ended than executive coaching, because normally if you have some serious personal issues to deal with, it takes longer to show progress. Things like creating this positive self-image that I was telling you about, or positive self-schema, there are all kinds of tools associated with that, and it's like building a muscle. You have to practice it time and time and time again in order to make it work. And so that you don't necessarily want to limit that. But, you know, I'm completely open with the people that I work with. And we work together to decide when is the right time to go down in frequency or to stop. I've had some clients that have said to me, you've given me some great tools that I can use myself. I want to go ahead and try it now on my own.
Brilliant.
And I think that's great. That's very heartening to me, because that means I've made a difference in their outlook.
Jim, we've got 5 minutes left, and I absolutely don't want to leave you. I think this has been probably one of my actually favorite podcasts. We have a tradition where we ask 3 questions and then we wrap up. So Richard's going to ask the first question.
So we ask the same 3 questions to all of our guests. Jim Tapper, I don't know whether you see yourself as American, but you've lived here for 20 odd years or 30 years or whatever it is. So you choose. You're either president or you're prime minister for the day. In fact, let's do both. You're president of America, right, for the day. What do you change first?
I would change the way education is supported. I think teachers are way undervalued, and I think it's one of the most important things for helping kids and young adults to find a path in life. I support the trend towards more apprenticeships in the United Kingdom. I don't think that college is necessary or university is necessarily the best path for everyone. And to make that as available as possible to people, I think is really important.
So education.
So next question is very light and just fun. Have you had a music idol that you have lived and died by in your life?
Well, Bruce Springsteen comes to mind because, you know, he's one of my favorites. And when I was young and in school at Georgetown University, he was from New Jersey. He's from New Jersey, and he would come and give concerts at our university in a hall that only held 3,000 people, very small. Wow. And I've loved the way he's 75 years old now, and he's still going. And I think, you know, his lyrics are sometimes really poetic.
You're one of 3, actually, guests who have said Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
And somebody today actually said Meatloaf as well, which was quite an interesting one. I mean, each their own. Jim, what person in the business world, is there anyone has been a big mentor to you that you have to thank for the man you are and the career that you've and the path you've been on?
I had a mentor back in the United States who gave me my first job as a strategy consultant. And he saw in me the ability to do the analysis necessary and have clear thinking that others didn't really discover in me. And he gave me the rope, if you will, to hang myself, but he gave with a safety net. He was one of the best bosses I've ever had. And the other one, and I have to say, is the other one is a woman who I worked for at the International Energy Agency. She was executive director, which is a very senior position for a woman in those days in the 1990s internationally. And she gave her trust to me to be her second in command and the CEO, COO of the organization. And she was a great role model. So I would say those two are the two.
Do you know what? That's one of the things that keeps coming across, up with CEOs, and it's definitely a common denominator that lies with a lot of them. And it's all about people and empowering people, giving people responsibility and trust in people, which is clearly what that woman did for you. And that's what a lot of CEOs say, that you get the best out of people with trust and empowerment.
Jim, just to end, where can the viewers find you? Where have you got social media? Have you got an email, LinkedIn? Where are you?
So our website, Tapper Associates website, is what it says on the tin. It's www.tapperassociates.com. And all of the things, both from consulting and also therapy and executive coaching, are covered there. I can be reached at jim@tapperassociates.com. That's my email. And I'm also on LinkedIn, both the company and also privately on LinkedIn. So, easy to find.
Brilliant.
That's lovely. Well, Jim Tapper, thank you so much. What an intriguing story that you have. And I mean, so much for our viewers and listeners and for us to take away from just everything that you've said. What I love about you is... walk the walk and talk the talk. And it must be very rare the world over to have a CEO who is now a psychotherapist to CEOs. So, you know, you haven't just learnt what you're saying from a book. You know, you have lived that life too. And I think that's what makes you absolutely unique. Jim Tapper, thank you so much for joining us on V for Visionaries. From Ros and Richard, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks once again for listening to this episode of V for Visionaries, the how-to podcast.
We would love it if you could take a moment to click the follow button and hit 5 stars, as it really helps grow the show.
We'll see you in the next episode of V for Visionaries. Mm-hmm.